This is a production of Cornell University.
On behalf of Dean Harry Katz and the ILR School, I'm delighted to welcome all of you at this very early hour in the morning to come and attend what for us is a first, which is the first time that we've had a corporate CEO and his Senior Vice President for Human Resources here. I'm very pleased to welcome Bill Amelio, who is the CEO of Lenovo, and Ken DiPietro, who is the Senior Vice President of Human Resources at Lenovo and also an ILR graduate, to be here today. Dean Katz has a meeting right now of deans and provosts, and it will end at 10 o'clock, and he will be here for the latter part of the session. He sends his regrets that he's not able to be here right now. Now, I know a lot of you have classes at 10:10, so what we're going to do is follow a format where there will be a presentation for the first half of the hour, then there will be a question and answer period until 10 o'clock. There will then, at 10 o'clock, be a one-minute break where those of you who need to leave can just simply get up and leave to go to your classes, and then the question and answer session will continue until 10:15. So without further ado, let me welcome Bill and Ken and ask Bill to make a few remarks.
Well, it's an absolute thrill to have the opportunity to speak to you. I can see this is just like any other class, that everyone avoids these seats in the front. Little did you know that we put $20 bills underneath those seats, so those of you who missed that opportunity. I had graduated from Lehigh University, just down the road from here, so it's great to have an opportunity to be here. I actually worked several years in Endicott, New York, so I'm very familiar with upstate New York, and the conditions that you have to endure sometimes in the wintertime. And this is a great part of the year because it's still wonderfully warm and you have an opportunity to be able to enjoy the outside. I think you're getting a chance to at least get an idea of a different kind of company that we have. We have a theme that we called New World, New Thinking, and here, New World, New Winners. And I actually like to say New World, More Winners. Because if we view the world as not a zero-sum game, that there's winners and losers, I think it's a better way for all of us to think about things. I mean, with some of the latest current events, it's hard sometimes to think that way because it looks like there's always somebody that's going to win and somebody that's going to lose. But what we've noticed over the course of the last 20 years is more and more people are literally coming out of poverty. Sometimes the news doesn't tell you that. I mean, if you look over the last 20 years, essentially 70 million people per year have been coming out of poverty. It's creating an immense middle class across the world with more money to spend, and the economic order of the world is adjusting rapidly. And it's actually quite interesting to think about where the next new companies will come from, because it's not clear what roots they're going to have. I mean, our company is one that's a unique company with the fact that we have roots in China and we have roots in the United States, which makes it a very interesting combination. Can you imagine putting together two companies as well as trying to put together two cultures? That's why they had somebody like myself and Ken run it, because that gives us an opportunity to really be able to get emotion going, to get people excited about how we can move the company forward. Because I think that in order to build a company, you got to get people passionate about what they do. At the end of the day, it's all about doing great work. I mean, when you leave here and you go to do your assignments and your jobs anywhere else, make sure you find something that you truly love. Because if you don't love what you're doing, it's really difficult to really make an impact and make a mark. Then you're kind of just trudging through life each and every day. I will tell you, every day I wake up in the morning, I am excited about getting started and being able to do what we need to do. Because this isn't for the faint of heart. We're an industry called PCs. And if those of you who have watched the margins in the PC business will know, they're very tight. Therefore, making a mistake is very difficult on us because we don't have that much room. We don't have a long tether, so to speak, with a number of mistakes that we can make and still be profitable. And in the economic situation that we are today, it's interesting, I think, that a few things you got to think about to be successful, especially in an economic situation today. You got to be fast to act, you got to be decisive, and you got to be able to confront reality very quickly and not be confused with the signals that are out there and have false hopes that things are going to go a certain direction and they may not. That's difficult for a lot of leaders to do when they've been rooted in a company for a long, long time. One of the great reasons why the more experiences you have, the more opportunities you have to be able to see things a bit differently. We'll have a chance today to talk about lots of different things, anything that's really on your mind. But one of the things I wanted to let you know what's unique about our company that we think and we hold dear to our heart is this idea of diversity. Diversity we want to use is literally a competitive weapon for the company. And how do we use that diversity as a competitive weapon? Now, we have the East and the West. We have several different cultures. We essentially do business in 160 countries around the world, 60 of which we have presence in. So we have lots of people that give us influence across the world. There's a lot of data that would suggest that the more diverse a city is, the more productive it is. The more diverse the board of directors are, the better decisions they make, and the more diverse a company is, the more innovative it becomes. We believe in this as a core value of our company, that we need to figure out how do we make sure that we value this idea of diversity. I have an argument that goes as follows, that if, in fact, the world is improving and innovating faster today than ever before, one of the reasons is because best practice sharing happens a lot quicker. Well, we all seem to be connected to the web. It's quite amazing how many people, even in the rural areas around the world, you can find connected, and they get the latest level of information. Today, you can innovate not starting from ground zero. You actually innovate from where the last person had the best practice, if you're open to the best practice. Now, translate that to a company for a moment. The biggest difficulty in a company is to not have the antibodies inside the companies attack new ideas, savage them, kill them. That happens all the time. And the idea that we have is to be able to make sure we can cherish these ideas and make sure we respect each other's ideas. Now, when you have a group of Easterners and Westerners get in the room together, sometimes that doesn't work well because the learning patterns are so much different from the people that have been born in the West and the people that have been born in the East. One of the things that Ken will talk about is some of our East-West training to try to get us all on the same page with respect to how do we behave appropriately with each other. Let me give you a fine example. If there's silence in the room, Westerners are very, very uncomfortable. And within less than seconds, they will fill the airwaves up very rapidly. Our Eastern colleagues like to think. They use that time to think. And when they want to respond, they think. They think deep. They think even deeper before they respond and give an answer because they want to make sure they've really thought it through. No answer is right or wrong, but it's different. And then when you get two different people in the room, sometimes what ends up occurring is the room gets overwhelmed by Westerners talking because they think, talk, think, talk, think, talk. And that becomes unnerving sometimes for others in the room. By having this East-West training and getting people better attuned to each other's behaviors, it's very interesting how all of a sudden we now get better ideas on the table that stick. We also tried to put a reward system in place inside the company where we want to align objectives, measures, and rewards, and also reward not only the person who comes up with the idea, but also the person who takes that idea and implements it elsewhere in the company. If we're able to get best practice sharing and implement it elsewhere and not have somebody say, you think that's a good idea, let me show you five other ideas. If we're able to do that, we can effectively raise our game pretty effectively across the world. So that's been one of our critical objectives for us to be successful as far as the company goes. I also touch upon an idea that we have inside the company that we think is important, is corporate social responsibility. You hear a lot of companies talking about it. We take it to heart. It's something that's pretty important and pretty deep in the values of both sides of the company. The IBM heritage comes rich with that, as well as the heritage in Lenovo. As an example, when the unfortunate earthquake hit China, and literally our teams jumped to the front field very rapidly. We had volunteers on the ground almost instantly. We had thousands of people lined up giving blood and sending it down to the stricken areas, and millions of dollars flowed into the province from Lenovo because we think it's important to make a stand and the importance of when something happens of that magnitude. And we do that elsewhere in the world for hurricane issues that have occurred in other geographies and some of the tsunamis that occurred, et cetera. We think that's important because it's a value inside the company that people feel good about. Not only do they feel good about it, they feel like this is the kind of company that we want to work for. And then we want to transcend that from corporate social responsibility to ISR, individual social responsibility, because each one of us have a responsibility to be able to do for somebody else. I like to think about this idea that says, to whom much is given, much is expected. And everyone in this room, a lot has been given. And the fact is, as you move forward, there's a lot of things you want to do that says that you want to make a difference in the world as far as your career goes, but make sure that you try to pull somebody else along the way as well. It's the most rewarding thing that you'll do in your life. When I look at great leaders, what I see in the great leaders is people that have the ability to have what I'll call a gene for coaching, and the ability to be able to see something in others that they may not see in themselves, and be able to then get them excited about the fact that there is a different way to lead, to get people motivated and enthusiastic about making tomorrow better than today, especially in the news that you hear today. I mean, if you listen to some of the people on TV today and read the papers, you would suspect that if today's bad, wait till tomorrow, it's even going to get worse. That's not what leadership's about. Leadership's about trying to figure out how to find the optimism and to try to pull us out of the ditch, not put us deeper into the ditch. That's the whole idea of what you look for in great leaders. So before I keep going on, because I can have many topics to talk about, what I wanted to do is run a quick video about Lenovo, and then come back up and talk a little bit more about how the company's put together, and then we can get into some Q&As.
Thank you very much. For those of you who just came in, there's stacked chairs over there. There are also some empty seats here in the front, so please don't sit on the floor, but make yourselves more comfortable.
Bienvenido a Lenovo.
Lenovo में आपका स्वागत है.
Dobro prozhavat, Lenovo.
Welcome to Lenovo.
Lenovo's DNA is equal parts ingenuity and imagination. It is the combination of the number one PC company in China and the icon that gave birth to the PC industry.
There's an openness that we have at Lenovo.
We are very unique because we integrate the Western and the Eastern together.
In a way, Lenovo started in 1981 when IBM launched its PC division, and with it, the PC industry. But we also began in 1984 when a small group of Chinese engineers started Legend Computers with a whopping $25,000 of startup capital. Legend changed its name in 2003, taking the first syllable of legend and combining it with the Latin word novo for new.
The fact that it's an American company, a European company, a Chinese company, if you like, you know, to be in this kind of international environment, I think that's really a good place to be.
In 2005, Lenovo bought the PC division of IBM, forming a $13 billion startup. Today, we're a member of the Fortune Global 500.
Even though that we have different culture and different views, we all agree in one thing, that we're trying to build a great product. And that excites me. And that excites everybody.
As exciting as the work and products are, testing them on live TV is positively thrilling.
Bill Amelio, Chief Executive Officer at Lenovo, with us on set, has a couple of computers with him.
One of the things that's unique about ThinkPads is the fact that I can take a glass of water, spill it on here, and this system will still work.
I got water right here, you know. Let's do it.
No, no,
come on, why not? He said it'll do it. Why wouldn't it? I mean, of course.
You can't pour a whole bucket on it.
Hang on.
Look at that. It's firing up.
It is.
It's that mindset of risk-taking that embodies Lenovo. We don't want to merely lead the industry, we want to define it. We introduce new ways of doing business, such as world sourcing, that meet the demands of an ever-evolving global market. The world map is changing, and tremendous economic power, innovative thinking, and great talent exist all over the planet. It's not enough to have the best people and the best products. You have to demonstrate who you are and what you stand for. You have to build your brand. Lenovo made a big bet on the Olympics. We launched a global advertising campaign with some pretty unusual ideas. A troll in an airport, a jogger vaporized with lasers, and sumos flying over Sydney. We provided 30,000 pieces of equipment and 600 engineers to power the largest sporting event in history. There were 302 competitive events spread over 17 days and only one chance to get it right. When it was all over, Lenovo was ranked by media watchers and major business publications as the top sponsor of the games. We got a big bang for our buck. But sponsorships aren't all we do to build a name for ourselves. Through joint marketing ventures with partners like Microsoft, Intel, and Dolby, Lenovo extends its reach and its product appeal even further. Hush, little baby, don't you cry. Mama's gonna sing you a lullaby. Dolby surround sound on the new Lenovo IdeaPad. Lenovo. 10 years ago, who would have anticipated the impact the blogs, forums, and video sharing sites would have? Lenovo's web and viral ad campaigns are now a vital part of our strategy. One viral video lit up the blogosphere for days and currently has over 1 million hits on YouTube. The best strategy for any company anywhere is a no-brainer. Never lose sight of who makes it all happen. The customer. Whether our client is sending astronauts into space or athletes into history, our goal is to surpass the mark we set before. Because here, we don't just strive for perfection, we engineer it.
Okay, let me take just a couple of minutes now and I'll give you a little bit of an outline and framework of where we've been as a company since the acquisition, talk a few minutes about world sourcing, and then talk a little bit about the Olympics. And then from there, hopefully we'll get into some questions that these comments I'll make will spur some ideas in your mind. First, about the company. So back in 2005, Lenovo was looking diligently to be able to go across the world and be a global player. But we had difficulty being able to do it organically, going into several different markets. We attempted to do it, but we just couldn't get the traction that we needed in markets like Australia, like Western Europe, like the United States. So the best strategy for us was to do an acquisition, and what better company to do it with was a company like IBM and the IBM PC Group. In August of 1981, essentially the world changed when IBM put the first business PC out in the marketplace. In fact, I was part of the IBM company at that time, and it was quite amazing when the early projections came out of the PC. There was actually a white paper report, I wish I could find it, that suggested that the number of PCs that would be sold for the life of the entire, all of us, was 5,000 PCs. Just to give you a sense, there's over 1.2 billion installed around the world today, and the next billion will be installed in the next 6 to 7 years, just to give you a sense of where the industry has gone from that particular point in time. A few years later, Legend was formed, 1984, as you saw on the slide, with 11 entrepreneurs and $25,000 of seed money. When we did this acquisition, it was a big deal from the standpoint of the Legend company was about $2.9 billion, and the IBM revenues were $10 billion at the time. Today, we're roughly a $16-plus billion company on our way to probably $17-18 billion this year, so lots of growth in this industry. But it was viewed in China as the story of a snake swallowing an elephant. And then with all the ramifications associated with how do you do an integration of this magnitude across different companies as well as across different cultures. Well, we set a three-phase plan up. Phase one was for us to make sure we demonstrated to all who were IBM loyal customers that we were a good steward of the ThinkPad brand. And that essentially meant for us to be able to get out in front of all of our customers and demonstrate we were going to make the brand right. We were going to continue on the path of great reliability, great quality products, heavy on features, light on price. That was the kind of the game plan that we had to demonstrate. In the first year, we lost a little bit of revenue in the side outside of China. Let's say our about 6% revenue drop. We got it all back and more the second year simply because we were able to demonstrate with a lot of new products that we were able to be good stewards of the ThinkPad brand. In fact, we took the IBM logo off. This device here, you'll see the first one, is the one with the IBM logo not only off, but Lenovo on the cover. So it's the first one that we ended up doing that with. And a lot of our analysts, media, and board of directors would have suggested that wasn't such a hot idea, taking the IBM brand off 2 years early. But a few of us got in the room and said, you know, from a cultural point of view, Ken and I had lots of discussion about this, from a cultural point of view, it's very difficult for the people that were part of the IBM team to really feel part of a new company if every day you go into work and you look at the IBM logo as opposed to looking at your logo. You then get a sense that the ships are still there and you can go retreat anytime back to the old mothership. And the fact is, we're trying to create a new company and we want to burn those ships so you can't go back. That's the idea, is that you're part of the new thing. And the best way to do that is to rally around your own logo. Equally important was the fact that we had to have customers feeling good about the fact that they were okay with us changing the logo. So we went on a campaign. Some of us traveled to many different customers and asked them an important question. What would you feel like if we took the IBM logo off the machine and put a ThinkPad Lenovo logo on? And literally 95% of them said, I don't know why you haven't done it already, because a Lenovo person comes and sells me this, and then a few weeks later the machine arrives and we get confused on, is it IBM or is it Lenovo or what is this? This is a very confusing situation. It still wasn't good enough for a lot of our stakeholders to feel comfortable to make that decision work. So we then, in our special bids desk, we went out and asked customers to make a choice. Do you want to have the IBM logo or do you want to have the Lenovo ThinkPad logo on it? And for a period of about 3 months, we did that work, and literally almost 100% of them chose the Lenovo ThinkPad logo. So we made the change, not a hitch whatsoever, and we had a major sort of symbolic event in the company where we actually had everybody tied in by satellite, and a few of us went to some of the major sites and we did logo changing. We had all the senior managers walk around changing logos on everybody's desk so you could feel comfortable that now you're part of the new company, and we have arrived and we made the move. So that was phase one of stabilizing the brand. Phase two was for us to be able to build a culture, come together as one, and to become unified. And when Yang Chengyang first brought the company together, even before I joined, he used three words to describe what we think is important for us to be successful. And those three words were trust, respect, and compromise. And the team did a good job the first year of being able to use those three as guideposts to help us move forward. But after the first year, I kind of talk about it like a honeymoon. Think about those of you who are married or have boyfriends or girlfriends, and think about the initial year, the first year. It's always wonderful. Everything's great. Then all of a sudden, one day you wake up and you say, there's some things here I didn't know about before. And that's no different in a company. The same thing happens inside of a company where all of a sudden you start, expectations might not have been quite met the way you thought they should be met. You have questions about some of the colleagues' capability in the company. You have questions about others' accountability. And there's a skepticism that can breed inside the company. If you don't do something about it, it can essentially erode the value you have inside the company. Well, Ken and I realized that. In fact, Ken did a lot of work on surveys inside the company to find out right under the surface we had a brewing trust issue, mainly the skepticism issue. And what we did was we gathered the top team together and said, we have to fix this problem. Because unfortunately, in a lot of our meetings, people weren't talking about the real problems. The white elephant was in the room and nobody wanted to talk about it. We call undiscussables. And people would essentially have those discussions outside the room instead of inside the room. So we had a trust workshop that essentially helped us bind together and learn the fundamentals of what it means to trust somebody. Essentially, how important your integrity is, how important your intentions are, the capabilities you bring to the job, and delivering results. Making and keeping commitments are so important. In fact, it's not only important in work, it's also important at home. We also learned how we can better effectively run a meeting to get more people participating and feeling comfortable with what we're doing. I think that was one of the watershed events that we had in the company that helped pull us together, and we've now worked hard to try to cascade that throughout the entire organization. We're trying to build a company that's high in trust. Difficult to do, because there's always the skepticism of people reading the tea leaves, wondering what direction management's really thinking about. Do they really want to tell you the truth or tell you what's convenient to tell you? And what we're trying to work hard on is to make sure people tell us the facts, tell us the unadulterated truth, tell us about the white elephants that are sitting in the room that unfortunately sometimes management can't see, but others do. The third element of our strategy was to then put a growth strategy in place, figure out the seams in the market where we can grow effectively. If you looked at the business that we had, the IBM business that we procured was primarily in large accounts, higher education, and we had a wide open space in small, medium, and business and consumer across the world. And consumer represents 30 to 40% of the market, depending upon what country that you're in. So great opportunities for us to grow, provided we could get some rich products in those areas. Other couple categories we thought we could win in would be the emerging markets. We had a great presence, as you would be aware, in China. One in three computers that are sold in China are Lenovo computers. Lenovo is essentially everywhere. In India, we made a great move in India. We got roughly 10% market share in India. And the other, what I'll call major emerging markets like Brazil, Russia, Turkey, just to name a few, we also are moving very rapidly. So that's another space for us to grow, utilizing the business models that are tried and true in China, replicating them elsewhere in the world. Another key area is getting into other categories like workstations and like servers, because that gives us an opportunity to be able to increase our margins and be able to get in higher value IT applications and become more of a full service supplier to our customers. So that kind of gives you a little thumbnail sketch of the strategy that we have, just a piece of it anyways. I mean, as you can imagine, there's a lot more depth and arguments that go into that. Early on, we put four major elements in place to get the company really rolling on the stabilization and growth strategy. First and foremost, we looked at our supply chain and saw that our supply chain was very weak outside of China. Almost best in class in China, if not best in class in China, outside of China, woefully short, and was an Achilles heel of the IBM business for a long time. We hired some outside talent. We done some extremely deep thinking work on Six Sigma and lean expertise in all of our operations, leaned out our facilities, the value mapped all of our processes, and essentially took out cycle time, took out defects, and today we're bouncing up against best in class on the supply chains. That was like the number one thing we had to fix. In fact, our sales team had a real skepticism about whether we could ever fix it because they heard for years and years and years, and some of the sales team sitting there nodding will tell you that we couldn't deliver on time. Now our time from an order to delivery is the best it's ever been in the company history. Second thing we wanted to do is to get our desktop business that was very profitable inside of China, profitable outside of China. And over the course of the 3 years, we've been able to do that. Third thing we had to do was to take a model that was tried and true in China, that was very successful in China, helped the China market actually grow. It's called the transaction business model that essentially serviced small customers and medium-sized customers. We distilled it down, understood exactly the key elements of that, and then started to roll it out across the world, starting in India, then Hong Kong, then Europe, Middle East, and Africa, then the United States. And it's helped us grow our small, medium business. And then finally, building the brand, which leads me to the next topic on the Olympics. Let me tell you about the Olympics for a moment. It's literally almost a life-changing event, at least for me. I mean, the feelings I had with being a part of the Olympics was something that was very, very unique. If you think about 1964 for a moment, Japan came out with the Olympics and Sony's brand was born. 1988 was South Korea coming out party and Samsung was born. And 2008, it was the Beijing Olympics. It was our opportunity as Lenovo for our coming out party. Now, let me give you a sense of the complexity of doing the Olympics. We essentially were the IT backbone behind the Olympics. We had 30,000 pieces of equipment, as you heard on the video, 600 plus people behind the scenes, engineers and technicians, making sure everything worked. We had 7 iLounges where athletes and coaches could go in, do emails, do Skype, do whatever they needed to do in order to stay connected. We had 100 athletes that were blogging with YouTube videos as well as text about their experience and feeling about being part of the Olympics. The Olympic torch was an important part of what happened to us as well, and it bodes well for this idea that we call world sourcing, because we actually used 10 different countries to come up with a winning design to get the torch. The torch had to go against 300 other design shops for Lenovo to win out. We were the first top sponsor ever to win the torch. And the winning design was because of the diversity of the thinking that we had behind putting that idea together. And the idea is called the Cloud of Promise, which was a connection of China's past, present, and future. It's rolled up like a scroll that represents paper and celebrates the invention of paper by China 1,000 years ago. If you feel the torch, it actually feels almost uncannily like a human hand. And the idea was that when you would pass it from one hand to another, it would be like you'd never let go. So you're constantly one person touching it across the world. And if anyone's had the opportunity to ever hold the torch, did anyone in this room ever hold the torch? Well, I guess I could be the one that could tell you I held the torch. I had the opportunity to run the torch in San Francisco. And I can't begin to tell you the emotional feeling it has to have that in your hand and be captured, that moment in history, and to be part of something that's so special in the world. I mean, to bring together 17,000 elite athletes in one spot and the celebration of unity, peaceful, as well as the celebration of the human spirit, is something that literally is an uplifting experience. And to be a part of that is something really, really unique. From our point of view, we had to activate this Olympics. And the way we activated it was when you first step foot off the airplane in Beijing, and the new Beijing airport now is a sight to see. Those of you who might have traveled to Hong Kong, it was architected exactly like the Hong Kong airport, but it's about four times its size. To put together this operation that we had to put together is almost like putting together a Fortune 100 company in essentially 2 weeks. That's the kind of complexity it has. And the message that we gave customers is, if we can do this for the Olympics, imagine what we can do for you. Now, you can imagine on day one how nervous I was, knowing the responsibility of walking into the Olympics and the opening ceremonies and seeing all this happen and thinking to myself, if something goes wrong, guess what? That's the end of this. There's no upside at that point in time. So I was kind of wound tight. My wife was asking me, geez, you don't seem like you're too relaxed during the opening ceremonies. But by closing ceremonies, when almost the full 17 days had gone, and we were flawless performance at that time, I was so happy with the amount of preparation we did for literally the last 2 years to get this to work. But as I mentioned, you stepped off the airplane. The first thing you saw was signage across the airport that welcomed you from Lenovo. Then when you went into the city, you saw 600 buses that were wrapped with Lenovo signage and talking about our value proposition. At each of the bus stops, there were Lenovo advertised. You couldn't miss Lenovo anywhere you went inside the Olympics. And in fact, you saw one of the commercials there. We had to actually take some of those down because the IOC wasn't happy that we had the sportscasters with a big Lenovo logo as they were talking, so you couldn't help see Lenovo on it. And some of our competitors, of course, complained, so we had to unfortunately take that off. I also want to apologize to those of you who are Mac users in here and saw that little parody that we did there. But I apologize for that, but it's true. I think before I conclude my remarks, one of the things that's important about a company is what's the heart of the company. And the heart of our company is innovation and this idea of getting people to become product evangelists. I mean, whether you're the CEO of the company or whether you're the frontline salesperson, you have to be excited about the products that you have. You have to be excited about the values of the company that you are in. You have to be excited about the products that are in the company. Otherwise, why are you in this company? That's one of the most important things. I am personally delighted to always be a product evangelist and tell people about why I love the products that we have and what's unique about our products versus somebody else's. And I think that has to run deep in any company, because you got to feel like you're connected to whatever organization you're in. Because if you want to do great work, as I opened up my remarks, you have to really feel like you're connected to the business that you're in. Well, with that, hopefully I stimulated some thoughts and some questions. If not, I know Gary has a few he'll ask us, and we can start the panel discussion.
Thank you. Okay, now the way we're going to proceed, for those of you who weren't here at the beginning, is we have a question and answer period that will run until 10:15. At 10 o'clock, there will be a one-minute break so that people who need to leave for classes can do so, and we'll resume then. Now, there's this microphone which people need to come up to. No? Okay. The proceedings are being recorded, so if you have questions, just ask your questions, and our guests will be happy to answer them. So who would like to go first? Yes, please.
So first, thanks for taking the time to come today. My question is, what were some of the techniques for helping people feel comfortable in meetings when, you know, speaking the, as you put it, the unadulterated truth about those, you know, those white elephants in the room?
Yeah. You know, I think, I mean, we recognized that we were having some failures. I mean, when we'd sit in meetings, and to some extent, it still goes on. I mean, I think we're on a path of getting better, and I think there's much greater awareness of some of the complexities of managing in a company like ours, where there's so much diversity. But we'd see symptoms, you know, you'd be sitting in meetings and literally the Western colleagues would be yapping and talking and controlling the meeting, and all of our colleagues who weren't like from the U.S. or from Western Europe, as it was, you know, from the U.K. or France, would be literally watching this go on. And, you know, you first conclude, well, they don't have a point of view, or maybe they didn't understand because we're speaking so fast. But it's a combination of things. And I think the catalytic was, you know, we learned a lot, we talked a lot, and we listened about what some of the issues have been with how to effectively work in this environment. And, you know, certainly our East-West training, and in fact we've modified it because we even see that some of these issues exist within region. And so this training is really an opportunity to bring teams together, and in it we explore deeply, you know, at one level, cultural diversity. You know, what is it to be Chinese? What is it to be an American? What is it to be? And you can't spend, you can't have a 6-credit study on anthropology in a day. But we cover enough that give people a context to understand communication challenges, style challenges, and how hierarchy works, and the way culture and religion informs even how we behave. And we spend time and a lot of discussion on that. And then we get into tactics to be more effective. Speak slowly. Check for understanding. Send out an agenda ahead of time. State your intent up front. Record the meeting. Someone keep track of time. Have a coach, a buddy, you know, so that we assign people in meetings so that if a colleague is struggling, we can, on behalf, are you catching it all? What do we need to do? Because Bill said it, and it's... It is in our DNA. We win when we get everyone's participation. And our advantage is that we are so different. And, you know, the ideas that each of us have are together an incredible asset for the corporation. But until we learn to listen better and communicate better and are able to pull ideas and synthesize and distill them into actions, we don't realize that potential. And so it's a competitive issue for us. In these sessions, these East-West workshops that we're actually rolling out, I mean, we just had one last week. Our services team did one, and it's he brought the guy who runs services for us is an English person, but you know his team is incredibly diverse. I mean, I wasn't there. I was told that the session was emotional. I mean, people were actually crying at the end. And there was a sense of community and spirit about how we can win that wasn't there before. Our global head of supply chain and our president of our China business, they had a joint session with their teams because they were having some real issues with getting things done. And they came up with like a 10-point checklist of how they're going to comport themselves when they're in meetings together. And, you know, they start their meetings with a flip chart, review what it is they're going to do. Now, if you are, you know, from Ithaca, New York, and you've never left Ithaca, and your team is from Ithaca, this is like a yawn. It's a no-brainer for you. It's like so simple. But for a company like ours, where we're fusing lots of diversity real fast and compressing it, these are really vital and important and actually somewhat breakthrough things for us. And especially... I mean, look, I'm an American. I'm quite Western. I speak fast. I use a lot of jargon. I can be prone to hyperbole. And when I'm talking to an Easterner, sometimes their eyes roll back, you know. And I have to, you know, and I have to be aware and conscious. And I have to encourage my Chinese colleague or my Singaporean colleague to challenge me. And even that is a different, it requires different skills and different learning, because how we approach conflict and conflict resolution is much different. So, you know, we use the term world sourcing, and we think we're on the sharp end of an exciting time in the history of commerce. But, you know, in many ways, we're a laboratory for human behavior and human performance in this new world. And I'm not trying to romanticize that, but I believe that in my soul. That's what makes my job so exciting.
I would just add a couple things to summarize, because Ken touched on the things that we do inside the meetings to make them more effective. But this idea of stating your intentions up front was a very powerful idea. And we also said that we put the 5-minute or 10-minute rule in place. If you were a native speaker of English, we gave you 5 minutes before we attacked you. if English was a second language, you got 10 minutes to get your point across before you got savaged with a lot of ideas and opinions from the team.
Savaging and attacking is when you're standing up and presenting. Typically, the person presenting or sharing an idea in a PowerPoint presentation, usually they got 1 minute before the first slide came up and people were asking 35 questions, so the guy couldn't even get through the presentation. So the rule is 5 minutes before you ask a question and 10 minutes for a non-native language.
To make sure that you could articulate what the idea is. We also train people to change the way we do presentations, because a lot of us are ADHD. And therefore, we don't wait that long, and we're kind of a little impatient. So the way to fix that is to do answer first. So I suggest, as you're thinking about when you want to be clear with somebody, it's always good to tell somebody, here is the answer first. I'd like to tell you the recommendation, what my findings were, and then you can get your supporting evidence behind that, as opposed to the wind-up, which is you kind of build this slow story that takes maybe a half an hour to finally get to the end conclusion. And a lot of us are crazy by the time you get to the end conclusion. So that helped all of us be able to resort the way we do our meetings a lot more effectively. The other thing is that Ken mentioned is the summary. We spend time now after a particular presentation to summarize what the conclusions were and what the findings were, and to write them down on a wall and to say, go around the room, does everybody agree with what we just said? It's a simple thing, a simple technique, but the fact is a lot of times what we found was we all thought we were agreeing and nobody was agreeing, and that's not a good thing. So we then switched our style of operation to be able to do that. Another one, which is another simple thing to do, is that those of you who've gone into some business meetings now with the latest level of technology will see that people have their BlackBerries and their computers open. So we've forbid people to have BlackBerries and computers in there, and I become the person that goes around taking them all. And the reason is because it's very difficult to multitask. I mean, I know all of you in the room think that you're probably great multitaskers, but I'm going to give you a little story on multitasking for a minute. I thought I was really good at this, and I learned this important lesson at home. I had the BlackBerry out, the TV's gone, and I was pretending like I was playing with my 7-year-old kid, my son Bronson. That's a great name. He's a powerful little guy. So Bronson's looking at me. He says, Dad, you're not paying attention. Well, I see, yeah, I'm paying attention to you. I'm watching TV. I'm doing a couple of notes on the BlackBerry. I got this to do. I got that to do. All of a sudden, he reaches up, grabs my BlackBerry, throws it against the wall, looks me in the eyes, and says, now pay attention to me. And all of a sudden, it hit me like a ton of bricks, this whole point about, you know, if you try to do too many things, you might be able to do a lot of things, but you're never going to do any one of them really well. So those of you who like exercising, as an example, it's a kind of passion of my life and helps me be able to travel around the world better. If you're on the treadmill and you're reading, I suggest you probably don't have it intense enough. So I think you ought to just crank up the speed a little bit. You won't be able to read anymore, but you'll be able to do more effective exercise. I think it works a lot in a lot of places in our lives. So as far as meetings go, though, to keep people focused on what we're trying to do is what's important. And I think the only way you do that is to keep people on the one task versus getting off to several other tasks. So thanks for that question.
Please.
Yes.
Okay. Hi, my name is Paul. I'm a first-year Mylar. I have a question about brand. I know that everyone at Lenovo sees Lenovo as an international brand, but you mentioned that during the Olympics in Japan, that's what propelled Sony to the global forefront, and we see Sony as a Japanese brand. So do you think that people seeing Lenovo as a Chinese brand is a handicap, or do you, want to capitalize on that?
If I think I got your question right, is are we going to be viewed as a Chinese brand or an international brand? What's people going to view us? Is that a negative?
Right.
Okay. If you take a look at the company, we're working hard to position ourselves as a new world, new thinking company, meaning that we'll have roots in both the East and the West. And if you look at the makeup of our top leadership team, it comes from 10 different nationalities, as an example. If you take a look at our board of directors, it's highly diverse as well. We have essentially 7 U.S. passport holders, 1 Brit, and 4 Chinese citizens. So it's a pretty diverse team, or at least made up of the East and West components that we have. With respect to what others view with respect to our brand, clearly some countries actually view us as an international brand already. Some view us as clearly a Chinese brand. In some countries, that's very positive. In other countries, it's neutral, and in some countries, it's tending towards negative, especially when there's discussions that are happening with respect to trade imbalances and some of the issues of jobs leaving a certain country. And then this whole concept of zero-sum game. I mean, if the mentality of the entire country is that all the jobs are moving to the East, then there is a clear-cut disadvantage then to a brand that's sitting in a country where people think the jobs are going. That's a problem that we have to face with respect to every day on how we do our branding campaigns. I think the way to get around that is I think this is an important point, is that if you think about between now and the year 2020, the Brookings or the World Bank suggests that there will be a billion more people that are going to enter the middle class. And most of them will be coming from the emerging markets. It's going to change the economic order of the world pretty dramatically. And the way we view the world and the world map should change a bit, because it's not going to be Western-centric anymore. And I think that's good for every one of us, because that means the pie is getting bigger, not smaller. And in fact, the thing that allows us the ability to be able to not allow near-term supply constraints to cause a problem, because a lot of us heard that the doomsayers would say, oh my goodness, with the rise of China and India, they're going to use up all the commodities around the world, the world's going to come to an end, and look what happens. I mean, you know when things are a little nutty, when oil prices go up and the doomsayers come out and say the world's coming to an end because inflation's going to rise. And then when oil drops down below 100, the doomsayers come out because all of a sudden the world demand is collapsing around us. That's just, noise in the system right now. The fact of the matter is, over the long term, innovation is what trumps everything. I mean, I look at the price performance improvements of PCs as just one example over the course from 1981, where IBM had that 5150, what a wonderful name, that was first announced, to the products that we have today. I mean, we literally have a supercomputer on your desk today. What's built into this little system today was essentially a supercomputer in the 1960s. And that's unbelievable innovations that's been packed into something like this. Who would have thought in the 60s, those of you who were around in the 60s, there was this big issue with respect to putting pollution control on cars. And nobody thought you could ever get performance and tailpipe reductions that have happened today. I mean, there's literally 99% reduction of tailpipe emissions today. Still not good enough. We got to do better. But the amount of innovation that had occurred to make that happen over the years is literally remarkable. And if pressure comes on the system and we keep innovating, it's not a zero-sum game across the world. And I think that's one of the most important parts about building a brand, is to build the idea that the fact is it's going to be good for all of us to have an expanding middle class, a good for all of us to have countries across the world rise out of poverty and be more effective. So I think that's the major message. Yes, sir.
So springboarding off that, would you say that your sweet spot is really that emerging market space? Because obviously you have ferocious competition in the U.S. and Western Europe with Dell and HP, and et cetera. Is that kind of the strategy, is that as the emerging markets grow, Lenovo will be right there?
One of our key game plans is to protect and leverage our bases, and our base is China, obviously, and a base is large enterprise and global accounts. So there's two prongs of this. So when any global account, the higher education included, decides to go do a bid for computers, there's three players they think about. They think about Lenovo, HP, and Dell. So that's clearly a strong spot for us, and we have excelled in that spot over the last 3 years. Small, medium business is another area where we've now been expanding to. The toughest spot in mature markets will be for us is in consumer. Now, why would that be in consumer? Well, if you look at our direct web capability, we're actually doing extremely well there. But it's hard to get a top of mind with a lot of people on the web. So you got to get into retail. And the problem with retail is you get a value gap instantly. So it's a chicken and egg problem. The value gap means that even if you have the same features and functions as your buddy does or your enemy does, they want a discount. The retailer would like a discount, and they can demand a discount because they're so large and powerful in mature markets. That's not necessarily the way you go to market in every emerging market, which gives us a bigger opportunity to be able to grow an emerging market consumer first and to be able to do it a bit later in the more mature markets. As our brand gets more recognized, that value gap shrinks and the investment to make a big play in consumer becomes easier. So that is definitely a consideration for us.
What's the role or presence of the younger generations in your strategy as a market, as competitors, as potential talent?
Well, I can start with that and I'll finish. But
well, I mean, from a product set. I mean, I guess I'd let Bill answer that. But from a talent standpoint, and from a leadership standpoint. I mean, it's fundamentally vital for us. And, last year, I mean, I'll answer it from a staffing and recruiting standpoint. I mean, I think last year in China alone, we hired probably 3,000. We had 3,000 kids join us from colleges and universities across China. So in both the Legend, what was Legend, Lenovo, and IBM have a legacy of growing our own talent. And, that's been core to the model, and it will still remain core to the model. Bill mentioned in some of his opening remarks that, we needed to go out in the marketplace and hire some skills that we did not have, particularly if we were going to compete successfully and fix some of the impaired parts of the business that existed in the time of the merger. But, I think ideas come from everywhere, and I think some of the bold ideas come from people who are less skeptical or more skeptical perhaps, and less worried about taking risks. And typically that comes from a lot of our new hires that come off campus.
I'd add to that, with the advent of social networking, it's a good way for us to tap into what's happening in the talent across the company, give people a way to have an equal voice over just the management that's in the company. One of the things that Ken didn't touch on was on some of our talent reviews. We actually go deep in the organization and we're extracting out where the most talented people are everywhere in the company and making sure we're watching them carefully and giving them the right experiences so they can be successful and be able to have great judgments on what our future products look like. There are also ideas out there that say, how do we get the entire company to kind of vote on what we're doing, just to say, is there a way for us to get in touch with the consumer base, even inside of our own company, to say that the ideas that we have, is that going to make it in the marketplace? So we're thinking through, how do we do that a bit more effectively, not only to do our customer focus groups that we do, but to use the power of our own company and some of the young people in our company to make sure that our ideas are on track and moving in the right direction.
How has the concept of cloud computing changed things at your company, or has it? Is your computer going to contain the applications 10 years from now, or is it just going to be the gateway to them through the internet?
This is a fascinating discussion, because even 10 years ago that was on the radar screen, cloud computing. I mean, so it's not nothing. They changed the name a bit, but it was something that was even talked about 10 years ago. I would tell you that there's going to be a place for both. It really will be. It's going to take a while to be able to say you're going to get it all off your desktop, but clearly there's going to be cloud computing in some of our products right now. Tap into that. As an example, we had a rural PC application that's out in the middle of China right now that essentially takes applications from the cloud, pulls them down for the farmer to look at crop tip planning ideas, animal disease control, distribution, pricing. And by the way, let me use that word pricing, because pricing is a very interesting thing. If you get transparency of pricing, it's a very powerful tool. I was shocked myself about how impactful that is for a rural farmer to really know when's the right time for them to sell their goods and to understand what market is the best for them to sell. They will travel even farther if they know they can get a better deal somewhere else. They'll do their own little calculation on the distance versus where they are. But having transparent prices is really important, and computing allows you to do that pretty effectively. Yes, sir.
Sort of following up on that, in the sort of tight margin PC business that you're in, maybe you could comment on how you balance that against longer-term research and how you plan to address longer-term trends like, you know, iPhone-like devices that subsume more and more of the notebook capability.
Let me start with the idea, first of all, of when you're in a tight margin business. What's very interesting is this, is that if you're at the best, what you can do is really grow great leaders that are both execution-oriented and are able to look around corners and have strategy. That's the success model. If you can really do that, then those kind of people can really lead almost any company in the world, because you get that in your muscle fiber, the ability to be able to react quickly, but yet be able to be strategic in your thinking. And that's what we're trying to get in place in everybody's thought process. So let me start with the execution-oriented, because I think that's important. I think in order to be effective executive or leader, in, at least in our company, and then I've seen a lot of companies, the ability to execute. And everyone uses the word execute, but what does that mean? That means having the right KPIs that work on the critical few things that really matter, and don't get sidetracked on the trivial many, which so many people figure out how to do. They get off track and they lose track of what's really important and what they need to look at each and every day, each and every week, each and every month. When we break a quarter down into 13 weeks, every day matters in our business. We don't have a big annuity stream. If I don't sell a computer, we missed revenue target for that day. It's that simple. So we have to be able to make sure you have you break things down into simple ideas and don't let complexity overwhelm you as well. So that's what execution is all about. Now what we do to make sure we don't get totally sidetracked and just work on execution and think about these bigger ideas is we have a research and development team where we focus on what are we spending our money on, where are the big bets that we want to make. And as a collective leadership team, we regularly get together and talk about the big bets we make. There's a few of them that we're very proud about that we made, and there's a few of them that I can personally say that I wish I hadn't made. They were bad bets. We drilled a hole and there wasn't any oil that came up. But there's a few that we've done that we're pretty proud about that made a big difference. I'll give you an example of one, and it was tinkering around in the research group for a while. And one of the things that we've worked hard on is to get the research team to think more about commercializing something. And because the research team would love to tell me this, well, Bill, you can't track me for 5 years. I mean, come back in 5 years and you can tell me if I did well or not. I said, well, I'm sorry, that's not going to happen. That's not the way it's going to work. We need to look at your portfolio of things that you're working on, and we're going to figure out how we can quickly grab a few of them, even if they're not quite baked yet, the idea, and see if we can get them in a product. Because the most fulfilling thing for any developer or any research person is to see what they're working on. It actually makes it into a product that customers like. That's great. You should feel terrific about that. So example of that is virtualization is one idea, is that we had this, use virtualization on a lot of servers, but not on client. And virtualization essentially allows you to run two different operating systems on a computer. And some of the what you're seeing now with instant-on capability is essentially using a version of, a virtualization lite is what would be instant-on. But you can take that to a lot bigger degree where you're able to have a whole set of products that come out because you have this virtualization technology. We have some great patents that are written, some really great technology associated with that will be coming out in some of our future products that will give us really a leg up in the next 6 to 12 months as we announce the lineup of that, primarily because we went into the research lab and we looked at some of the things that we're working on. But it's this idea of still looking out in the future and saying, what's the next big idea that we need to go work on? The other thing that's been difficult for us to think through, and no one seems to have cracked this yet, is what's the product that's between this and this? Because those of you who have BlackBerries, iPhones, whatever, you can do so much on a small screen, but you still like a bigger screen and you still like to type like this. I mean, we're not getting away from that. And in fact, there's ideas that say, well, you flash a screen on your table and you use the table as typing. Well, that doesn't work so well either because you don't got that feedback that you like to have on a keyboard. So all of this is being thought about and worked on, but it still hasn't transcended into a real product that really does what you want it to do. Too many people are making too many multifunctional things, and all of a sudden nothing works really well. It's not a great phone, it's not a great email device, nothing works right. It hangs all the time. The worst thing you have is a thing to hang. My biggest bugaboo, I'll tell you as a technology leader, is this. I think the car guys really get this, and we don't yet, which is almost every car that's getting made today has an onboard computer inside of it. In fact, it runs most of the things inside the car. Now think about how frustrated you would be if you pushed the start button and you had to wait for the boot up to happen. I mean, they get it. You push the button or you turn the key and something actually happens because it's bypassing the boot up sequence. And that's essentially what we've got to work on with computing. When we got to get it to the point where we take a lot more of the bugs out of the system that create hangs, that create memory leakage, so your system doesn't behave as when you first bought the system, it's fresh, it's quick, and all of a sudden, as you load some things on it, all of a sudden it starts behaving a little differently than the day you bought it. And we'll work on it. That's what building long-term customer satisfaction and an unequaled ownership experience is all about.
Okay, before we take the next question, we've reached 10 o'clock. Take a one-minute break so those of you who have to go to class may do so, and then we'll resume momentarily.
It's clear to have you here. I've been watching your news since the day one you come on board at Lenovo. I think it's a great achievement you have changed Lenovo as a typical local Chinese company to become an international brand. So my question to you is, in the past 2 years, what's your biggest challenge you have when you work with your senior Chinese team? Like, I know the founder was Chinese, and the ex-CEO and the CFO, they both are Chinese, but now it's become a more diversified international team. So what's your secret?
That's a heavy-duty question. That one, we can go down a lot of paths with that because, you know, as you said the question to me, my mind was filling with lots of memories of some of the transitional issues that we had and how we bonded as a team. And I will tell you that what it took was the two of us, Yangqing Yang and myself, to figure out how we're going to really trust each other more than anything else. And there were some tension in the air on several occasions, on several key decisions that needed to get made. And what you hope for as a CEO is that your batting average on making the decisions is better than 50%. It's be good that you can do that, because you're not going to get 100 on every one of them. You're not going to get every one of them right. And what has to happen is a lot of dialogue in between on being able to understand each other's positions and being as patient as you can to listen to the other person's viewpoint. That is probably the best advice. But there were clearly some times where there was lots of tension in the air on what we were going to do as a business. And let me give you one that I think is powerful. If you take a look at the top senior team right now, you'll see that we're made up of about 30% Chinese colleagues in the top leadership team. Somewhat had expectations when the merger first happened, it should be more like 100%. But Mr. Liu, who was very wise, and Yangqing as well, realized that the Chinese colleagues from day one didn't have every skill necessary to become instant global executives. They did a fantastic job in China. But in order to be a global executive, it takes four different things to be successful. One is you have to have command of the English language, because that's the language of business. Unfortunately, that's one thing that all of us have to do. Second thing is you got to have a business management system that transcends your own country. And if you only grew up with one, that may not be able to transport somewhere else. And if that's the way you think, you have to be able to have a business management system that works in other places. Third thing you have to do is you have to be able to be culturally sensitive to other cultures around the world. And the fourth, which is probably the most important, is the ability to influence others. If you grew up in one company and in one country, people around you kind of forgive you for a while after we all have blind spots. There's some things that we have as tiring strengths, and there's some things that could take us off our path. And people, when you work with them for a while, if you're a solid leader, they'll forgive you for some of that. Now, if I transplant you instantly and put you in another country, those people don't know necessarily who you are, and all of a sudden it can become a problem. Another case in point is this, is that in Eastern companies, hierarchy is a lot more important. Like, for example, I was surprised when I first became the CEO of Lenovo. I walked into Beijing, and it was instantly I was recognized as the as a position authority as the boss. And I got granted instantly that feeling. When I went into a meeting in Raleigh, North Carolina, I'll never forget this. I walked in the meeting, sat in the meeting, and it was almost like people were saying, well, who are you?
Even going through the security. If you didn't, the security wouldn't let us in. She just refused to let us in because we didn't have a badge. Didn't matter who we were. You're not coming in. Yeah, but he runs the company. I don't care. He's not coming in.
But the point of view about that is that's totally different. So if your mindset is you're in charge and all of a sudden you go somewhere else and you don't get instantly recognized as you're in charge, that plays with your mind a bit. And it's a little bit difficult if you never had that experience before to make that leap. So one of the things that we're working diligently in the company is taking some of the best talent we have in China and putting them through intensive training on being able to say, how can you work effectively in other cultures around the world so you can be a global executive? And we've been successful now at moving some people and taking risk on them a little early because we've given them the right training. We also had some high-profile flameouts where we put some people in jobs that weren't quite ready and they weren't able to, you know, rise to the occasion. And that's something that we like not to do. Thanks for that question. Very difficult.
Yes, I understand that Lenovo has lost government contracts, U.S. government contracts, due to national security concerns. What are you guys doing to address those concerns?
That was more like a few years ago. You saw there was a big press article that came out with the State Department literally about 2.5 years ago now. Since then, we have won government contracts. We've done a lot of work to actually have third parties come in, look at our manufacturing processes, our procurement processes, and demonstrated that we, in fact, have the highest level of security, and nothing has really changed since the IBM days. And it gave the government a lot of confidence. In fact, we were one of the few companies that got the CTAT approval, which means we actually have we're able to import to the United States without a lot of inspection. We have been identified as having the best practices in the industry for what we've been able to do. So we've taken this thing extremely seriously, and we've gone the exact opposite way to be able to demonstrate to everybody we have tight processes in place and we're highly secure, and you can bank on when you get a Lenovo computer that there's no special software in there, spy chips or anything else that you got to worry about.
Sure. Hi, I'm AJ Filialini. I'm an MBA student, and I want to ask, in integrating, you had two different cultures, East and West, but also you had a more of a startup culture at Lenovo and a more staid culture at IBM. How did you go about merging those two cultures?
A key observation. I mean, you know, you'd almost, when you go to China, sense of excitement and that tomorrow is going to be better and the future is now, and it was people walking fast, smiling, the energy was palpable. And then when you go to some of the acquired facilities, you know, in Raleigh or in Paris, there was this almost forlorn atmosphere. And, you know, it's interesting. It was an interesting time because, I mean, the product is just superb. You know, it's a high quality product, and there's great pride in the cultures. But you know, I think nothing works like conveying a sense of hope about the future, and then creating a set of plans that are executable and winnable, and conveying, you know, through your actions, you get hope in the environment. But I don't think there was one single thing that helped bridge the cultures, because in fact, while that was one set of conflict, IBM and Lenovo China, when we started to bring in talent from the outside, from HP or from Dell and other places, it introduced another set of conflict. And you know, I described that tension that existed. In one sense, it was healthy because we were really consciously saying, look, there's a departure. We're moving forward as one company. But, you know, Bill talked about the trust workshop we've done, and a lot of the culture work we've done, the East-West workshop, the culture compass, which was this forum for dialogue, getting clarity around our strategy, getting clarity around what the leadership framework was going to be here. What did we want leaders and managers to do, and how were we going to hold you accountable? You create a set of frameworks and belief systems, and you start measuring against that, and you able to start to gap or close the gap, if you will, between what was and where we are today. And so it's not one event, it's a set of strategic initiatives that you do that I think has helped us, you know, because we don't want, I mean, I guess we feel good that people say, I was at IBM, but I'm a Lenovo person. You know, I used to say, look, paycheck doesn't say Dell Inc. or HP, it says Lenovo. And so, you know, at some point in time, we have to leave the past behind. And Bill calls it, you know, burning the boats. You know, this is it. You're not going back, you know. And we literally have a process in place to control the flow, you know, of who gets to go back to IBM. And it was, in some regards, we had some executives that were quick early on to tell us that they had a return ticket. And we said, take it now, because we're going this way. And obviously, you have one leg in the past and one leg in the future. That's a place you're, you know, that's not a, you know, imagine this picture, what that looks like. And that's not fair to the rest of us who are here sailing the good ship Lenovo. Why don't you get off? I mean, was that blunt?
I was at a couple things. Ken painted this picture, which is a great picture, is that when you used to go into some of the buildings, we were in the oldest buildings in IBM. We were still part of the leased buildings in IBM. So one of the key strategies that we had is pull us where we had concentrated populations into new buildings, new Lenovo, and a totally different feel. Like our campus down in Morrisville now is, it's spectacular. I mean, it's contemporary. It was jointly designed by the China team and the U.S. team. It's got feng shui all built into it, so everything is like the water runs in the right spot, so the money doesn't go out in the front door and out the back door. We figured all this out. That's great. But that, I think, is an important symbolic thing, is to get people to move into a work environment they feel comfortable about. The other one was a big one, which was the commitment culture. In the China group, they had a fantastic commitment culture. Edgy, when they put a target in place, rest assured, they're going to make the target. There was never a doubt in your mind that if the China team put a number on the board, they would beat you down to try to get a lower number at the beginning. But when time came to make the commitment, they made the commitment and they would make it happen. The other culture was a bit different. Their targets would come from finance, which were usually 120% of what was humanly possible. So therefore, you know, it sounds like a reasonable approach. I think this is an interesting thing to discuss. It sounds like a reasonable approach, but it's deadly for a company. Because what happens is it breeds a company where you don't make commitments. Instead, what you do is the person that could put the best excuse chart together at the end of the quarter and says, here's the 15 reasons why I didn't make this, and you know, I did 90%, it's good enough. So you build a culture where 90% is good enough for everybody, or 80% is good enough for everybody. And that's not the kind of place you want to live in. That's not an edgy culture that's pushing the limit. You have more people explaining away the problem versus figuring out what the root cause issues are and figuring out a solution to get things fixed. So that was a major changeover that we had to do, is to adjust targets in the right spot, but to make sure that we made people make commitments and keep commitments and hold people accountable to that. Otherwise, you don't build an accountability culture, and it's deadly in a company.
Let me just ask you a question. It's 10:15 now. Going to have a coffee break. Would you like to continue with this for another 15 minutes?
I don't know what time I'm supposed to go. Yeah, 10:30. Okay, we can keep going then.
All right. So anybody who would like coffee or soft drinks, they're available in the room right next door. So feel free to help yourself and come right back.
Yes, sir.
I want to talk a little bit about commitment to service, because some organizations forget about that commitment to service. Case in point, Dell. I bought my first PC from Dell 2 years ago, 4 years ago. I updated it 2 years ago. I bought a new computer from them. I had horrendous problems with Dell, and I was not alone, as I find out by looking at the news wires today. Michael Dell coming back as the CEO. One of the chief reasons he's coming back is because the hit that Dell took from not making a commitment to service to customers that have bought their products. How important is that commitment to service, and how do you ensure that your original customer is going to come back to you another time when he wants more?
Best way to describe that is tell you what our strategy is. So let me just give you our strategy, and I'll give you some proof points on that backs our strategy up. We put a strategy together 3 years that said the following. Most companies have this first part of the strategy, which is to try to grow faster and more profitably than the industry. Our game plan to do that is with exceptionally designed products, exceptionally engineered products, with unequaled ownership experience. That's our service motto, unequaled ownership experience. Behind that, we've put a lot of muscle in our entire service arm across the company. Case in point, if you look back 3 years ago, we were about number two in the TBR survey that goes out, and it's a third-party survey in the United States. It looks at all customers and asks them, who do you like, who don't you like, what's the good, bad, and ugly of every customer. In desktops, we're like number four or five. Today, we're number one in both. We made dramatic improvement. We have a team that spends all sorts of time on the blogs, and if anything pops up, because it gets around our customer sat group, because we have a customer sat group that if there's any time an escalation, that's the first place that the escalation goes, and we go fix a customer's problem. We want to save the sale, save the customer experience, so they will become repeat customers. All of us know the following, this, that the world has changed. In the old days, it used to be if you irritated a customer, they tell eight people. Today, if you irritate a customer, they tell thousands of people because they get online and they start the blog. So it's so important, this idea of customer sat is critical. If you can't stand behind the customer, I submit to you that what's going to end up happening is it's going to destroy your value over time. So it's an extremely important part of what I do, and I spend a lot of energy on customer sat in not only large accounts but also individual consumer that have issues as well. And we're not perfect. I wish I could say we haven't made any mistakes. Rest assured, I've had some glaring things come to my office and describe some of the problems that we have that we continually keep working on. But I will tell you this, each and every one of them, we go to root cause, we put a corrective action in place, and we get better at our ability to be able to make sure that we live up to this idea of an unequal ownership experience.
And we put pay against it.
And that helps.
A variable.
Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I mean, our a dimension to our bonus scheme is tied to customer sat results. So to the extent we perform or don't perform, it affects all of us.
About the little white machine.
Oh, the little white machine.
this is a brand new category. In fact, it's called a netbook. And the difference between, let me first describe the difference between this and this, the full-fledged laptop and a netbook. This is for simple gaming, light graphics. You're not going to do high-intensive computations on here. You can do, of course, social networking and Skyping on here. You can attach to the internet pretty rapidly, do email on here. It's a nice...
Got a camera built in, right?
Yeah, got a camera built in. And it's got the latest processor, and it's a beautiful, you know, form factor, and it comes in all the various different colors that you'd like it to have. And it's a great machine on the road, as a matter of fact. But if you're going to do lots of typing, lots of spreadsheets, lots of computations, this is the guy that you want. So that's the difference kind of between the two of them. This is a more of a consumer box. It's got the 4-in-1 inputs that you can put here as far as your various different media, SD, compact cards. This one also is WAN capable as well. So you can put a WAN card in here and you're able to connect literally anywhere around the world. And the price points on here are really a lot lower. This attracts a totally different set of customers. It's great for the education markets. It's great for second and third computers in some households. And then for emerging markets, it's great for their first computer.
And that's available on the market.
Right now, yes.
Seen it.
Is that Linux-based?
We have them both. We have both XP and Linux-based. And this is one where we'll work on more of the cloud computing. Somebody asked me that question earlier. This is one that can... Yeah. This one's a mock-up. It does. Unfortunately, can't turn that one on. I don't know why we didn't have the actual one here, but that's why...
Might as well pass this around,
yeah.
Too.
Yeah, they were saying
just don't leave with this one.
This is the CEO's one, yeah. So don't not take that one.
They locked the doors. Yes. They were saying that this one will sell for $399 to $499, depending on what
those are live. There's the
really cheap.
This is the 110. This is the U110. This was actually our first this really was our first consumer box, right?
Yeah.
This is you could describe it. This is a full-on fully loaded, all apps, laptop, mini laptop, but it's kind of feminine in design, but it's got this one best. This is, I wouldn't walk around with it, but it's actually won best in show at CES this year in January, best new laptop in the computer science exhibition, international show in Vegas this past year. And it's got some real clever design on it. It's almost borrows some of the Chinese characters in the back and the cooling vents, and comes in what, red for
red
now?
Black.
Red and black now. And it's got the piano keyboard, and it's a cool product.
So people come to they've got the discount?
Excuse me? Yeah, we're giving one of those to all of you who are left here.
Well, I mean, we'll give your friends and family discount.
So I'd like to ask, I've seen what you've written and said about Global 2.0. Can you elaborate on that for this year?
Yeah, we got around this idea of the world map needs to be viewed differently, not from a Western-centric view of the world anymore because of this massive switch in how the middle class is growing elsewhere in the world. And it's important for companies to be able to tap into talent anywhere and everywhere. If you think about just a few years ago, and unfortunately some people are laggards here in their thinking, I would say in the United States, on outsourcing and offshoring, is that that was the bad word of globalization, as everyone thought that everything's leaving the West going to the East. And our viewpoint is a little different than that. What we're viewing is the fact that there's global hubs of excellence that you can build everywhere in the world to tap into the innovation and the budding middle class and the budding talent pools that are developing all over the world. And one of the ways that we structured our company is exactly to do that. We have global hubs of excellence in several different spots. From an innovation point of view, we have one in Beijing, Yamato, Japan, and Raleigh, North Carolina. Manufacturing, we essentially have all over the world. Supply chain, we actually have a global hub of excellence in Scotland because there was great supply chain skills there as well as business transformation skills in Scotland, to give you just an example. And this idea is that because you got talent, you can tap into it. And also, those markets are becoming big markets under their own. I mean, let's talk about China for just a moment. China is the number one market in the world for televisions, number two market in the world for automobiles, number two market in the world for PCs, number one market in the world for washing machines and refrigerators. It's a pretty big domestic economy, and some people don't really realize that today. So it's a great market to sell in. It's a great area for us to be able to sell our goods. So companies that are thinking with just a Western-centric viewpoint, they sometimes don't think about the nuances that may happen and how they got to design products a little differently for a market like China or a market like India, because India is another burgeoning consumer-based economy, and there's all sorts of ideas that can happen there that are unique. We also, there used to be a viewpoint that in emerging markets, they would look for secondhand equipment, refurbished equipment, et cetera. It's anything but that. In fact, some of the latest technologies are first adopted in some of the emerging markets, even before they're adopted in a mature market because of the inertia to move to the new model. Cell phones is a perfect example. If you go into rural India, you'll find people that are living on $2 a day and they got a cell phone. You got to say, how does this all work? But they got a cell phone. And it's kind of unique because they leapfrogged putting landlines in because they were so expensive, so they went to the cell phone. And that's similar to what we're seeing with respect to even higher-end technologies. I mean, it was quite fascinating. I had a discussion with somebody from Fortune yesterday who just got back from India, and she was traveling around, and she said, I went to this one village, and they were trying to sell me an iPhone for $700. And she said, the guy, all he has to do is sell one of those a week, and man, he's in. And the fact is, because it was not a market for them, they figured out how to get some of them over there, and they're just selling them. So it's interesting how all of a sudden you'll see something because status drives people and brands drive people, even in areas that where you wouldn't expect it.
I'm wondering if what you did differently, if you had to motivate former IBM employees to make them more like a Lenovo employees now.
What would we do differently, or what did we do?
What did you do if you had to do it? To motivate or to encourage former IBM.
Take a shot at that first?
Yeah, I don't think we ever set out to target the IBM employee, but Bill talked about establishing a culture of commitment. We've talked about the trust work and working on our culture, but one key intervention that I think we've done to operationalize what we mean by leadership and management and create a standard definition, if you will, and I'm not literally meaning definition, but to be clear about what we expected. We put in place a talent evaluation and management process, and a lot of companies do this, but I think what was different for us was the rigor. It is different for us is the rigor and sense of ownership that really comes from Bill on this. And I'm not, you can chime in anytime you want on this. And we're in the middle of this work right now. In fact, this window of our business calendar. This period of time is where we actually are conducting these reviews. And what happens in that meeting is, you know, we sit with business unit leaders and we spend a day going very, very deep in their organization. And we want to understand what your business objectives are. Do you understand them? And then how is your talent and organization paced, matched to achieve that outcome? And so we spend a lot of time looking at people, and we ask lots of questions about who are the best, who are not performing well, what are your plans, what's your bench look like, what are your staffing plans look like? And those discussions have multiple effects. One, you get deep understanding of the organization. Second, you get a good understanding of whether or not the leader or manager knows his or her people. Third, you get an opportunity to communicate very clearly what your expectations are of managers and leaders in the company. And then, you know, when you build into it a follow-up review 6 months later and other things to operationalize those plans, what happens is you're creating a an intensity around what we mean by commitment, leadership, and management. So it may have worked one way before when you were with IBM, or where if you were at Dell, you may have experienced it differently, but this is what it means to be here. And, you know, what happens is you're also making decisions about the person in the room discussing, and they know it, you know, because later that person's boss is doing another discussion with Bill and I, and then we roll this up to the board. So that is one example, I think, of how we've, I think, operationalized the idea of a culture of commitment and created the Lenovo leadership way.
That's a tough question to ask. What would you do differently? And I would just give you something from my experience on this one is that I had 18 years at IBM. I would have definitely handled this job much different if I hadn't changed jobs several times. And I'll give you an example of that. The training I had at IBM, which was fantastic, the management leadership development early on, but one of the things that was drummed into me early on was it was your responsibility as a manager to make sure you bring all people along. You shouldn't leave anyone behind. What I learned as I went to other companies and I learned some different approaches, I changed that thought a bit. When you do a major transformation like we've just done in Lenovo, what's going to end up happening is about 30% of the people get it instantly. They're a part of it, they want to go, and they're going to move with you. Another 30% are sitting on the fence and wondering if you got a strategy that works, can you execute it? These guys or the leadership know what's going on. They're going to vote depending upon what happens over the course of the next several quarters. Then you got the rest that might say, this is not for me, I got to move. And if you spend a lot of time working on that population, you're missing the boat, because what ends up happening is you're focusing on an area of weakness, not an area of strength. And one of the things that we tried to develop in our entire people talent process is this idea of the following, is get people in jobs where they're maximizing their strengths and they need to understand what their towering strengths are, and also give them feedback on where their areas of development are, what their things that could derail them off their career. Because if those of you in the room here, if you haven't got great feedback somewhere along the way, it's going to be difficult to get in great leadership jobs, because if you got a blind spot, it only comes out in crisis, unfortunately. I mean, when things are smooth sailing, anybody can run the operation. It's when a crisis develops, can you really dig down deep and not let your dark side or your derailers push you off target? And one of the things that we built inside the company is this whole culture of giving feedback and how important feedback is. I like to say that feedback is a gift. Sometimes it's unwanted and unwelcomed, but it's a gift no matter how you look at it, because it makes you better. Because if you're able to listen to it and be able to say, I can make a change, you will be better in the long run.